crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Welcome to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nachtigall. We are not coming to you from Jerusalem this Sunday. We're actually recording this in the United States of America. I'm on the campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College right now in our recording studio. This, of course, is the college where who supports the excavations of Dr. Ilat Mazar in the northern part of the City of David, and also on the Ophel excavations, which are just below the southern wall of the Temple Mount. And, of course, our history with the Mazars goes back even further, back to the time of her grandfather, Dr. Benjamin Mazar, one of the first archaeologists, or the first archaeologist, to receive an archaeological dig license after Israel became a state in 1948, and then conducted some of the largest excavations ever seen in the state of Israel, those being at the southern wall of the Temple Mount. The Temple Mount excavations, which ran from 1968 onwards for about a decade. Our college was involved back then, sending over hundreds of students, all total after the decade partnership. And then after that, teaming up with Yigal Shiloh in the northern part of the City of David as well, working in Area G there. And now back in 2006, we've been working alongside Benjamin Mazar's granddaughter, Ilat Mazar. And we are looking forward to, hopefully, another excavation in the future, continuing there at the Ophel, uncovering more from the Solomonic period, which is what you expect to find on the Ophel if you follow the biblical narrative and you treat that as being historical and accurate. Solomon, of course, expanded the city of David outwards, further north. If you're going to the only place that you won't find a valley, to the valley in the south, you have the Hinnom Valley, and then to the east, you have the Kidron, or Valley of Jehoshaphat. And then the west, the Cheesemaker's Valley, or the Tyropian Valley, whichever you would like to call that. Of course, Solomon couldn't expand those directions, so he had to expand further north onto to this geographic region of the Ophel before you reach the Temple Mount. Anyhow, our excavations are hopefully continuing there soon. But I am back in the United States for a couple of weeks to see some friends and family. But we're not going to give up on archaeology or talking about archaeology on this program. On the second half of today's show, we're going to focus on Iran and their march across the Middle East right now, and their strategy to link up territory all the way from Afghanistan to the Mediterranean Sea. There's been a number of stories about this over the past week and a half or 2 weeks, as it seems Iran is focusing their strategy on this border region between Syria and Iraq. What I find interesting about this is when Islamic State grew in power over this territory in 2014, early 2015, that was their goal, was to create a one state or an Islamic state that disregards those political boundaries that were set up in the wake of the First World War across the Middle East. And this boundary specifically between Syria and Iraq is the one that they're throwing down. And it looks like Iran, while the Islamic State is shrinking in its territory right now, it looks like Iran is going to carry on with that same goal, or pick up the mantle, if you like, after Islamic State is removed. Of controlling that territory. Well, the United States looks like they are going to not allow that to happen right now, but we'll see, and we'll investigate that on the second half of today's show, so you can stay around for that. I do want to talk about two archaeological stories, though, first. These came across the news wires, and I'll include these in the links underneath the show, if you're listening to this online, so that you can read them for yourselves. They're both two articles that are quite in-depth, and they have lots of nice pictures and graphics, especially this first one, which I thought was extremely interesting just because I teach a class here at the college surrounding this period of history after the exile during the time of Jeremiah, when Jerusalem fell, finally, in 586. And then all the way from that period to the 70 AD destruction, or 70 CE destruction of Jerusalem. Teach a class on that. And this first find really does showcase quite well or as an example of King Herod, that king that ruled Judea from about 37 BCE all the way to his death in 4 BCE. He was, of course, just a masterful builder, building such things as Caesarea on the coast, as this amazing port city that would be just a beautiful Roman-style city that Roman dignitaries, when they come to Judea, to his territory, that they'll see this land, or see this port, and just be amazed at his architectural abilities. Of course, he did expand the temple compound as well. He built Sebaste in the north as well. He built up he also built Herodium for his own tomb, and of course Masada, another place that he built up just on the western part of the Dead Sea, overlooking that. Well, on the other side of the Dead Sea, across from Masada in Jordan, is the ruins of a massive fortress of Macaris, and this is quite familiar to many people, namely because it is the slaughtering place of John the Baptist. That is what the Jewish historian Josephus talks about, saying that this was the location, as we'll even cover briefly here, where John the Baptist, John, who they call the Baptist, as Josephus writes, was eventually murdered by Herod the Great's son, Herod Antipas. Anyhow, I'm just going to read this story. It's from Haaretz. And again, if you want to read it yourself or see the great simulations of, or the recreations of, what it would have looked like, this fortress from 2,000 years ago, again, just overlooking the Dead Sea on the Jordanian side, you can go ahead and look at this article. It's entitled "Archaeologists Find Monumental Mikveh at King Herod's Palace in Jordan." And I'll just read the first couple of sentences. It says, "Archaeologists have uncovered a king-sized mikveh in the ruins of Macaris, a fortress built by the vassal Roman king Herod by the Dead Sea." And of course, he was a vassal king, or a client king of Rome, although he did have so much more authority than some of the later rulers. After his death, they have less power than he did. He ruled as king by virtue of the Roman Empire, allowing him, if he could take it back from the Parthian Empire, which he did finally in 37 BCE, then he got to rule over this territory for 30 years, and he did after he ensured that he could maintain his rule, and he killed a lot of the Hasmonean dynasty, the Maccabean dynasty, to ensure that they would not try and take over the throne or his rulership, then he began building all over Israel, including these ruins of Macaris. Of course, this was already a location or a fortress back from Maccabean times, but he greatly expanded it. The second sentence here says this: "The Macaris fortress was erected on a prominent hill about 32 kilometers southwest of Madaba," another famous place in Jordan, archaeological site. "The mikveh ritual bath and immersion pool used for purification were apparently built for the Herod, for the Herodian royal family's personal use. This bath is the biggest of its kind ever to be found in Jordan. It boasts 12 steps and a reserve pool containing water to fill the pool when the water ran low." So quite large, 10 steps down. I guess they're about a cubit, each of these steps. Generally, I think that's what the Mishnah talks about, how big these steps should be. And after excavating on the Ophel for so many years, that's one of the greatest features we have from the Herodian period, is just a large and abundance of mikvot, these ritual baths that were needed for cleansing before you went up into the temple. And since Herod was half Jew, he did want these set up in wherever his palaces, you can see them in Masada as well. And anyway, they found this absolutely massive one in these inside this fortress of Macaris, again in Jordan. I'll just read the next two sentences here. It says, "Beyond its sheer dimensions, the architecture closely resembles mikvehs," or mikvot, I guess they should write, "discovered in Qumran on the other side of the Dead Sea in Israel that had previously been considered to be unique." So they're similar in design to the ones at Qumran, of Qumran being, of course, the site where the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in the northern parts of the Dead Sea on the Israeli side. "The king-size mikveh was found 3 meters below the royal courtyard, where it had been hidden under 2,000 years of sand and dust. It had originally been equipped with a vaulted stone ceiling. The roof of the mikveh was destroyed in 71 CE when the Roman 10th Legion, headed by Lucilius Bassus, attacked the desert fortress, which at that point was sheltering Jewish fighters from the Great Jewish Revolt. And then it says they also found four Roman ballistic missiles. Well, probably they just meant ballast stones that would be catapulted in. And two collapsed massive column drums. So if you put this in the timeline, Herod, of course, built it, or he greatly refurbished this site. It probably remained in use partially, and then it was used as a retreat for some of these Jewish fighters and Jewish refugees that were escaping Jerusalem. Jerusalem fell in 70, and then this fell in 71, and then it would be a year or two later that Masada would finally, or the place of the last stand of the Jews, of course, when that was finally taken. This, of course, is also the location, as even the books of Matthew and Mark talk about, and Josephus talks about, of where during the period of John the Baptist, and now we're going into early 30 or a bit before then, CE, he was called before Herod Antipas. And when he was talking to Herod Antipas, of course, he is again the son of Herod the Great. After Herod the Great died in 4 BC, the kingdom of Judea was divided amongst his sons, at least three of them, Herod Antipas, Herod Archelaus, and Herod Philip. Herod Antipas, he ruled over the territory of the Galilee in the north and also Perea, Perea being this territory on the east side of the Jordan River. And that's why John the Baptist was taken to prison in this territory, because this is the one that Herod Antipas was over. He wasn't over Judea, but this area of modern-day Jordan today, he was over that. And what's brought out in those gospel accounts is that he actually talked to Herod Antipas, and he condemned him. Well, not condemned him, but he did judge him and say that you are living in an inappropriate relationship, as he was. He was living with Salome, which was his brother Philip's wife, and that he took her as his wife. And then he had a stepdaughter, which was known as Herodias. And Herodias ended up, while at a banquet here in Machaerus, ended up dancing before Herod Antipas and some of his advisors. And Herod Antipas offered her absolutely anything that she wanted. And what happened at that point is that she consulted with her mother, which was Herod Antipas's wife, or he was in a relationship with her at least. And she, Salome, wanted to get rid of John the Baptist. And he said, she came back to, after talking and consulting with her mother, Herodias came back to Herod Antipas and said, I want John the Baptist's head on a plate. I want his head on a plate. And since Herod Antipas had offered her anything in the kingdom up to his own rulership, he had to follow through on that. And that's how John the Baptist was killed. Anyhow, this fortress of Machaerus is being dug back up in greater detail than it has in years previous, and it will be definitely worth reading this account, because it does bring both those accounts of Matthew and Mark to life, as well as what Josephus wrote. And it seems that what Josephus wrote and the archaeological discoveries in this location are really detailing the very same history. There hasn't been anything found, as far as we can tell, as far as I can tell, from these excavations that would call into question Josephus's or the gospel accounts or that narrative. So go ahead and read that. Again, it's on the show notes, links below. The second article here is entitled Revolutionary Technology Reveals Dazzling Hidden Text on Biblical Era Shard. And this is from the Times of Israel. It's published June 14th. And it's just a really interesting piece, because it talks about these ostraca, which are potsherds that have inscriptions on them, written in ink generally. And these are found, I wouldn't say often, but they obviously they probably wrote some papyrus, anciently a form of paper, if you want to call it that, and that would generally deteriorate over time. Of course, the Dead Sea Scrolls, they were written on papyrus, but they were kept in an extremely dry location in the Dead Sea for so long, and that's why they were preserved. Well, if you're going to get writing from 2,500, 3,000 years ago being preserved, Paleo Hebrew script, The script of ancient Hebrew, not the square script that they use today, but the ancient Hebrew. Then it's on these ostraca or ostracon singular when you want to refer it in the singular sense, where you find that writing. And there've been a number of ostraca that have been found over the years. The Lachish letters are probably some of the most famous from around the king Hezekiah's time and thereafter, the time of Zedekiah, all the way up to the period of Judah going into captivity. But this article itself is talking about one ostracon from Tel Erad, and this is west of the Dead Sea. And there's 91 ink on clay shards, 91 ostracas that have been found. They were found back in the 1960s. Well, they were reviewing one of these with a new form of technology, a new camera. And what they had found is they only thought that there was writing on one side of it. And they wanted to just through various, you can read the article it goes into very specific details. I'm not a photographer, but if you are a photographer, you would be very interested in this. Anyhow, they did a number of scans and they revealed on the front where they saw the writing, more text, more lettering, and they could make a more full understanding of the reading of it. There were some 45, it says here, new characters that were added to the facing side of the ostracon number 16. This is the one that they did, half of the total. So almost 20 new words were discovered on the front of this. On the unknown side, so there was the other side where it apparently looked absolutely blank, but then when they put it underneath this this interesting type of imaging, what they found was there were 50 more characters, creating 17 new words. So what's interesting about this is you have writing on one side of this piece of pottery. On the other side, that looks like there's absolutely nothing. They put it under this new style of camera, which apparently is actually rather cheap, under $5,000, and you can create it. They find text that was invisible. Obviously, it wasn't visible when it was written, but over the past 2,600-700 years, it was smudged or taken, basically wiped off. And now they can read it for the very first time. And this is what this article says. According to the scientific secretary of the Academy of Hebrew Language, the existing inscriptions found in the Arad pottery hoard are already very important to the study of ancient Hebrew. The 91-piece trove largely consists of correspondence between military supply masters, mostly addressed to a person named Eliashib, who is thought to be the quartermaster in the fortress. Unsurprisingly, most of the language deals with words centering around foodstuffs and shipment orders. So they're not discovering ancient biblical names or personalities necessarily, but it is teaching us about how they wrote. It is teaching us about the day-to-day life of the Jews back here 2,600, 2,700 years ago. Then it continues, the inscriptions contain commands regarding supply of commodities, wine, oil, and flour to military units and movements of troops set against the background of the stormy events in the final years before the fall of Judah. They include orders that came to the fortress of Arad from higher echelons in the Judahite military command system, as well as correspondence with neighboring forts. Very interesting. Very interesting, talking about this period when the Babylonian Empire was coming down, mainly recorded in the book of Jeremiah, and coming down to take Judah into captivity. And here we have troop movements and what they need to bring with them discussed on these ostraca. Then it says this, ostraca number 16 is a letter sent from Eliashib to a man named Hananyahu. The team speculates he was a quartermaster in Beersheba and discusses the transfer of wine. So we didn't know necessarily that they were going to be transferring wine, but on this, at least on this specific ostraca, they flip it over and they use this new style of imaging. And there's text. There's text from 2,600, 2,700 years ago. It's in ancient Hebrew, just as you'd expect it to be. 1,000 years before of course, Muhammad. And here we are in, just basically telling us that the history in the Bible is very accurate. It's very accurate. There were Jewish people here. They had fortresses. They had fortresses in Beersheba. They had fortresses in Arad. They were sophisticated enough to write to each other to try and mount a defense against the Babylonian armies. And yeah, again, like I said, it's not dealing with necessarily a biblical personality, but these people are alive when the Bible was being written. This is what one of the people involved in this study said. Every letter, every chance to decipher anything improves our understanding of the text and the history, the economy, and the language of this period. It's amazing because it can suddenly be so easily seen. This is a very important development. So then he talks about how the fact that, you know, this is rather cheap. You can do this. They're espousing going back and looking at a lot of these other ostraca, checking the backside of them, checking other pottery shirts to see if anything was written on them. Of course, during an excavation, to before the pottery gets read. So once you excavate the pottery, you throw it in the pottery bucket, it's documented exactly where it came from. Pottery is just everywhere in excavation, so it's not anything exciting to find a piece of pottery necessarily. But then before an archaeologist will sit down and look at that, the assemblage that was discovered from that certain area or locus, it's washed. And it's washed a lot of the time by hand. Well, it is washed by hand and used sometimes little brushes that you would use to clean your nails in the shower. That is what is used. And when I've done this, I've wondered, well, am I rubbing off an inscription? And of course, it's good to check before you start scrubbing away, but it is a mundane job. And most of the time, especially if I'm an area supervisor and I've got to divide my labor, I'm probably putting those people that are less inclined to care what they're doing on the scrubbing the pottery to clean it up because they can't do too much damage in the field. And I want to get them away from the field as much as possible. So they're scrubbing the pottery, but maybe, just maybe, they're actually rubbing off some of those ancient ancient letters or ancient inscriptions. Anyhow, maybe there's a chance. Not that I expect every shard of pottery to be analyzed. That would absolutely be impossible. But at least where there is writing discovered on one of these, it would be absolutely just extremely important to go back and use this new technology. And if at random, this was discovered at random, they decided just to flip this over. They weren't even looking on the other side necessarily. That's not why they had the camera set up. They were trying to make out the letters that they could see more readily able to be read. And then they just flipped it over and they did an analysis and bam, another inscription. Again, from this important biblical period. If they would do that with some of the ostraca that we've already found, well, I'm sure they even say that they are going to do that from now on, at least those with this technology. And again, it doesn't seem to be too expensive. And this is, again, what this one of the Times of Israel report finishes this way. Speaking of one of these people involved in this study, my heart aches when thinking of all the inscriptions on the finds believed to be blank that were perhaps thrown into the trash because it was impossible to discern them in the field. The same thing as what when I was talking about this new technology of wet sifting. That's just amazing that it wasn't done till 20 years ago or 15 years ago for the first time. And once we do that, wow, we find all these amazing artifacts with biblical names of people on them or significant inscriptions, more bulle, more seal impressions, more seals themselves. Now, people talk about the lack of evidence, even though there is a huge amount of evidence out there of how the biblical narrative fits so well with archaeology. And they're like, people say, well, where are more of these inscriptions of biblical personalities? Well, you could say one. Well, just so you know, there's been about 50 people that are mentioned in the Bible that have already been attested to by different archaeological discoveries. And I'm going to do a program on that one of these days. But just imagine how much was lost because these technologies weren't around. The huge excavations that were conducted in Israel in the 60s and 70s and 80s where they didn't have wet sifting, where they didn't have these camera technologies. Well, there was probably, I think it's amazing what we found, what we have found in that period. Finds that talk about biblical personalities, biblical events. I think it's amazing that we have found certain ones, even, but just imagine what we could have found had these technologies been around. Of course, we can wish that, wish these technologies were available back then, or we can start using them right now in excavations around Israel. And it looks like that is what is going to happen. So again, I will leave this article entitled Revolutionary Technology Reveals Dazzling Hidden Text on Biblical Era Shard from the Times of Israel 2 days ago or a couple days ago. And you can check that out and read it for yourself. When we come back, we're going to be talking about Iran's march across the Middle East. And contrary or different to what you're going to hear elsewhere, I will fill you in on whether Iran's going to be successful in the long run of reaching the Mediterranean Sea via Syria. It looks like they will right now, but we'll analyze that question when we come back.
This is Watch Jerusalem on KPCG.fm.
The prophet Daniel wrote about a future confrontation between a power in the north and the king of the south. We are now in the time when these two major powers are quickly rising. The King of the South is stirring up trouble even today. It is critical that you know the identity of this prophesied power. For more, request our booklet, King of the South. Visit thetrumpet.com and click the Literature tab to select your free booklet.
This is Watch Jerusalem.
Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nachtigall. In the first half, we talked about archaeology, but we're going to change gears right now and talk about Iran, because we are at a very important point here in the Middle Eastern history, especially relating to the last decade and the last 5 years in particular, with the Islamic State, the Syrian regime, the Syrian civil war. Of course, that's been raging since 2012. And right now we are at a critical juncture, just because the Islamic State territory is shrinking, especially, right now they're basically confined, or mostly confined, to this area between from Mosul across into Syria, Raqqa, where their capital is, in this area. And as the Islamic State territory shrinks, what we've long said was going to happen was that Iran, especially in Iraq, is going to become the power player in those vacated lands. Of course, the reason being is because Iran has been used, has been using their different proxies. And if we're talking about what's taking place in Iraq and removing the Islamic State, we're talking mainly about the conglomeration of Shiite militias under the PMU, the Popular Mobilization Units, a force that has been very effective at a ground force routing the Islamic State from those territories. But as we expected, especially with decision making at the end of last year by the Iraqi parliament to basically allow, in the post-Islamic State world, this Shiite militia group to actually become part of the state's military. Of course, some of them would claim it would be better that it's under the control of the state. Well, basically, that could be true if the Iraqi state wasn't dominated by Shiites. Many of them, that while they like to cling on to their own power, they understand that Iran is the Shiite mothership that they are going to answer to. And Iran didn't mobilize these forces, didn't pay for these forces, didn't lead them through the IRGC, and expect nothing in return. No, they've got their foot in the door in Iraq now, and they're pushing all the way over to the Iraqi border. That's what we've seen over the last couple of months. Well, in this past week or 2 weeks, we've seen the same thing happening. A lightning fast offensive maneuver by mainly the Afghani militia that answers to Iran, that answers to the IRGC, approaching the Syrian-Iraqi border from the west and pushing eastward. and really splitting what looks to be Islamic State territory, and then also American allied, where American allies are. And basically they're making a run for the border to try and connect these two countries with Iranian-backed troops either side of the border. And this is incredibly important just because it is going to give Iran, if they're successful at this, a thoroughfare, a roadway, a way in which they can transport arms, which they've been doing for years, all the way across through southern Syria to Hezbollah in the southern part of Lebanon to become an even more powerful enemy or threat to the state of Israel. Of course, Jerusalem, Israel, they're great, one of the largest or most important goals for the Iranian regime, and they're getting their thoroughfare, Shia Crescent, some people are calling it, or this roadway, this land link, this land corridor, all the way to the coast. Now, what they have usually been doing to try and ensure that Hezbollah has the necessary arms it feels to confront Israel is that they have been flying them into Damascus from Tehran. And then from there, they get transported to convoys and then go across the border into Hezbollah's hands. Well, basically, since the Syrian civil wars began, especially in late 2013-14, when Hezbollah really jumped across the border of Lebanon into Syria to help out the Assad regime, who, of course, is allied with Iran, we've had the dissolution of those borders, of the border between Lebanon and Syria, and the border between Syria and Iraq. And now that that has happened, Iranian proxies are trying to ensure that they have a continuous land bridge all the way over, so they don't need to. They don't need to fly them into Damascus. They can just convoy them all the way over. Of course, Israel's Air Force has been ready to knock out some of those convoys once they get into once they get within range of the Golan Heights, and even doing the occasional flyover into Syria. But Syria is getting some increased or some more sophisticated anti-aircraft weaponry, which would put in danger Israeli jets flying over their skies, getting them from Russia. So that might be out of the question soon, which means you could have a serious buildup of arms from Iran pushing their way all the way over to near the Golan Heights, which would threaten Israel. And this is a very big danger. And it is a danger, it seems, that America right now, under the president, President Donald Trump, is aware of and is potentially trying to stop them from being able to fulfill this goal of this, trying to stop this creation of this land corridor. And right here in southeastern Syria, we are seeing, which borders on Iraq, and even in northern Jordan there, where those three meet, and then further up the border across from Mosul, this whole territory is the next major battlefield in the Syrian civil war, really the Levantine war. All across these states is where there is fighting. And it's very important because you've got a couple of options going forward. Iran, who is extremely committed to this goal, and who have basically told the world that this is their goal. They even had Qassem Soleimani, the head of their IRGC Quds force, the force that they use to export their warfare outside of the country. This man Soleimani, he's in charge of that force, the Jerusalem force, if you want to translate Quds. Well, he just showed up on the Syrian side of the Iraqi border, took a few photos. Those photos were released in one of the state media outlets in Iran. So obviously they want the world to know that this is their plan. And there was even an article here late last week on Friday or Thursday that came out in The Guardian talking about this plan. Wall Street Journal had an article about this plan as well last week. So everyone is aware of it, what Iran is trying to do. And that does just fit the biblical description so well. The Bible, of course, talks about Iran in end time prophecy, and that is, it labels Iran as the leader of this alliance of nations that is trying to take Jerusalem, and that will eventually, because of that, be very offensive in their warfare and actually motivate a sleeping giant right now in Europe, centered leadership centered in Germany, they are the ones, Bible prophecy says, is going to respond to this pushy foreign policy from Iran. Anyhow, what we're talking about on the border here is we have Iran setting up this strategy, and everyone knows they're doing it. Everyone knows that this is their goal. And yet, who is going to stand up and stop Iran from being successful at making this land bridge? Well, maybe it'll be the United States. And it looks like the United States, at least right now, they haven't really committed too many troops to it, but they are ensuring that Iran doesn't get away with a huge contiguous land corridor between these states, between these areas. Just in the southern part of Syria on the border with Iraq is a base that is controlled by the Americans, and they're using this base to train some of their allies as well in this fight, some of the ground forces. And what we've had is it's called Al-Tanf. And we've had over the past month Iran using their different proxies approach this base. There's meant to be a 35-mile deconfliction zone around this base. The Americans have said, you come in this area and we'll shoot you down. And there have been three or four incidents over the past month where Iranian forces have come into that area and they have been shot down. The latest one being last week, where a drone, a Iranian militia drone, dropped the munition on that base. The munition failed to go off, but they dropped one nevertheless, and then that was just blown out of the sky straight after that by a jet. But they're provocative. Iran's provocative. They're going to keep on pushing. They're going to keep on pushing, and will the United States stand up to them and not allow them to create this land corridor? We'll see. We'll see what happens with that. The United States, late last week, they did move their mobile artillery rocket launchers into this base. They brought them into Syria. This is the first time that this has happened from the United States in the Syrian civil war, in the fight against Islamic State, you could call it. But that's not why these are coming in there. These artillery are coming in because of what Iran's doing. And yet this artillery has a range of about 300 kilometers. So I believe this artillery is there to try and stop Iran from being able to complete this land corridor. We'll see. We'll see. We don't have too much time to discuss it, but there is an article about this subject entitled Iranian Militias Reach Syrian Border, and it's on Watch Jerusalem, and we'll leave a link. I'll leave a link to that article for you to read. But we really do need to watch eastern Syria right now as Iran tries to push forward with this plan, because it would really send shockwaves through the world, especially in Israel, if Iran was able to do this, because then they are controlling a strip of land from Afghanistan all the way over, from Pakistan all the way over to the Mediterranean Sea. Iran will have friendlies all the way along this roadway. Now, maybe they won't be able to keep it for long, and it would be difficult to hold on to this. But I don't think it's just the Americans that are worried about Iran's moves here. Biblical prophecy, as I was indicating before, talks about not the United States confronting Iran. The United States is not going to put a halt to Iran's march across the Middle East. They will not do it, even under Mr. Trump. You might have said under Mr. Obama that they would do it. Well, he did facilitate Iran's rise to an amazing degree, and the facts of that are only now really surfacing, not just with the nuclear deal, but many other instances. But now that we have Mr. Trump, who looks like he is aware of what Iran is doing, and even Secretary of State Tillerson this week talked about how they would be keen for regime change in Iran, which the Iranians, of course, didn't like. Well, the Iranian regime didn't like. I'm sure there were some Iranians that did like that type of talk finally from the United States. But Bible prophecy indicates that America will not be able to halt Iran's rise. That instead, there will be somebody, but that will be a German-led Europe. They are going to become aware of what Iran is up to, if not already, and they're going to have the power, which they have already, if they wanted to use it, to stop Iran. But they're also going to receive the motivation. And what does it take to motivate Europe? And we've been wondering, what is that, the answer to that question for a long time now. Maybe it is. Maybe it is what Iran is doing right now. Maybe they see the danger of Iran controlling this strip of land all the way across the Middle East. And maybe that's dangerous for their own interests. And we'll see, and we'll keep you abreast of that going forward. But again, please read this article. It's entitled Iranian Militias Reach Syrian Border. And if you want to get more of the backstory behind the biblical forecast that we have at Watch Jerusalem, you can also order for free. You can order a hard copy, you can download it, you read it straight away. A booklet by Gerald Flurry, editor-in-chief of Watch Jerusalem. It's entitled King of the South. And you should read that. You should. I think you'll be amazed at some of the forecasts in there based on what the Bible says, specifically out of the book of Daniel. And you'll be amazed because, you know, it has been updated just to keep pace with how this prophecy has been fulfilled over the past 20 years. But going back to 1993 and 1994, when that book was originally written, it was Iran that Mr. Flurry designated as this king of the south, that even though they were jostling for power with Saddam Hussein in Iraq, we labeled it as Iran that was going to dominate Iraq. And we've seen that. Iraq has fallen to Iran. So you can see that there's so much in that book that's already happened. But then you can see some surprising elements there of who is going to be allied with Iran also and who isn't. And one of those nations that isn't is Syria. So the Bible does indicate that Iran eventually is not going to be successful at controlling this territory all the way across to the Mediterranean Sea. Now, I understand that sounds absolutely crazy considering how entrenched Hezbollah is right now in southern Lebanon, how much of an ally they are of the Iranian Islamic regime. I understand that that does sound, for educated people that know about the region, for Middle Eastern analysts, that Iran is going to be ousted from Damascus, that it's going to be ousted from Lebanon. That sounds crazy. Well, but the Bible does indicate that that is what is going to happen. And again, you need to request that book, King of the South. Read it, educate yourself, and you can make sense of these events that are taking place. The ones right now we're watching, being on the border between Iraq and Syria. Thanks very much for listening today. That's all we have time for. Again, you've been listening to Watch Jerusalem. I'll be here for another couple of weeks recording from the studio of Herbert W. Armstrong College before my family returns back to Jerusalem. But we'll make sure to keep you abreast of those important events in the Middle East and also in the world of archaeology.